This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Look at our top stories this hour. Iran rejects as unconstructive and uncalculated a statement by three European countries expressing doubt over Tehran's commitment to sanction removal talks. Volodymyr Zelensky says Ukraine's army has recaptured some 2,000 kilometers of territory in September, adding the Russian army is doing the right thing in fleeing the counteroffensive. And the lighting of public buildings stops in the northern French city of Lille in a bid to reduce energy consumption as winter approaches and prices soar. Hello and welcome. We are coming to you live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Thank you for joining us. Iran has rejected as unconstructive a statement by three European countries censuring Tehran's stance and the JCPOA revival talks. Foreign Ministry spokesman says it's a regret that France, Britain and Germany have issued such an uncalculated statement as talks to revive the 2015 accord are still ongoing. Nasser Kanani warned the three European countries against walking in the footsteps of Israel, which is trying to derail the JCPOA revival talks. He says the European countries should accept responsibility for the consequences if they continue on this path. Three European countries said in their statement they have quote-unquote serious doubts over Iran's sincerity in seeking a nuclear agreement. They warned that Tehran's position jeopardizes prospects of restoring the 2015 accord. We have talked to political commentator Syed Mustafa Khoshchishm about the reason why the JCPOA revival talks have not been fruitful so far. Take a listen.
All throughout the past 10 months or 11 months, Iran has been the only party that has been offering initiatives. And the only time that the Western parties offered a new initiative was the last in the Vienna talks. But still, they try to reserve some concessions, some very important points for Iran that are called Iranian red lines, a closure of the IAEA cases, and removal of three, four ambiguous words that seem to be something subtle, something small, but they are not. They are a world. I mean, they are trying to trap Iran, actually. They are trying to just receive some energy supplies probably for a few months and then ruin the accord again. So they are playing fool, actually, with Iran. And since Iran has stressed that it has been very much constructive in the talks all throughout the past several months, it expects the Europeans and Americans, especially the Europeans that are facing very cold winter, they need Iranian crude, of course, not gas, but the Iranian crude that could be much helpful to their economies and, could save lives in Europe. But they still insist on pressuring Iran empty-handed.
Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps says it has seized a foreign vessel carrying some 757,000 liters of diesel out of the country. An IRGC official said the vessel aimed to smuggle the fuel to other countries. The official added seven members of the unnamed vessel, who were all foreign nationals, have been handed over to legal authorities. The fight against smuggling is the priorities of IRGC's naval forces. Since March, more than 1.5 million liters of diesel has been seized by IRGC's Navy. Almost 7 months into the war, Ukrainian forces are carrying out counteroffensives, taking back control of several areas from Russian troops. Ukrainian special forces say their units are now in the town of Kupiansk in the east. The advance has potentially trapped thousands of Russian troops. Ukrainian forces have also isolated Russians in the city of Izium and the Kharkiv area. Meanwhile, Kiev claims its forces have cut supply routes on the west bank of the Dnipro River. Ukraine President Volodymyr Zelensky says the army has managed to recapture some 2,000 kilometers in September, adding that the Russian army is doing the right thing in fleeing the counteroffensive. Moscow has acknowledged Ukraine's advances. The Russian military says the withdrawal of its troops is aimed at regrouping and building up efforts in the Donetsk direction, that is. Charles III has been formally proclaimed king by the UK's Accession Council, a ceremonial body that confirms the new monarch.
I am deeply aware of this great inheritance and of the duties and heavy responsibilities of sovereignty, which have now passed to me. In taking up these responsibilities, I shall strive to follow the inspiring example I have been set in upholding constitutional government and to seek the peace, harmony, and prosperity of the peoples of these islands and of the Commonwealth realms and territories throughout the world.
Charles succeeds his mother, Queen Elizabeth II, who died on Thursday at the age of 96 after more than seven decades of rule. The televised ceremony was held at St. James Palace, where the Accession Council assembles upon the death of a monarch to make a formal proclamation of the successor to the throne. Former prime ministers and other top officials attended the ceremony. A state funeral is to be held for the late queen in just over a week. Our correspondent in London, Robert Carter, joined us a short while ago to tell us more about why or what the royal family will be facing in the future.
Well, I think the royal family has had a massive blow time and again to its reputation in recent years, specifically because apart from Queen Elizabeth II herself, she was known for being able to, you know, maintain composure, maintain an aura of credibility, maintain respect of her institution that she represented. She was considered a very popular and well-rounded head of state, essentially by her supporters at the very least. However, her family members, not so much. In fact, many of them have been embroiled in all sorts of scandals related to racism scandals. There was, of course, her disgraced son, Prince Andrew, who, of course, was embroiled with the international grooming gang scandal linked to Jeffrey Epstein. These were, of course, deeply damaging to the royal household's reputation.
Social media users are asking for Queen Elizabeth II to be remembered as the UK's last head of state. Hashtag abolish the monarchy is trending on various social media platforms. People think that the royal family is a political institution which lives off people's taxes and doesn't make any contributions to the society. Meanwhile, calls are growing in former UK colonies in the Caribbean to remove the British monarch as their head of state. Some Commonwealth leaders have expressed doubt about what role a monarch is supposed to play in today's time. Activists also argue that Charles's accession is an opportunity to redouble calls for slavery reparations.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another Hashtag Trending with me, Ali Reza. Queen Elizabeth II, the UK's longest-serving monarch, died at the age of 96 on Thursday after reigning for 70 years. Aside from expressions of grief, the monarch's death revived criticism of her legacy, a legacy of colonialism and oppression. Upon the Queen's death, her eldest son and heir to the throne, Prince Charles, became king amidst all the public relations headaches and scandals that has gripped him, including infidelity in his ex-marriage, financial corruption, racism, and political interference. Many on Twitter remembered the Queen as a symbol of the British colonial empire, which worked through the decades to enrich itself through violence, theft, and oppression of other nations. Some also listed a number of criminal wrongdoings of Britain under the rule of the late Queen as a response to one of the tweets you will find here. It's written, here are some of the crimes committed by the UK during the 70-year rule of Queen Elizabeth II. So, for example, in 2003, chemical attack against Iraq by British forces. More recently in, for example, 2011, role in Syria crisis. And even more recently in 2015, support for Saudi Arabia's crimes in Yemen. Mirka replied to this tweet, by saying UK's monarch signs off on legislation. Some of those matters would have crossed her desk. UK's involvement is with NATO, and they're both equally responsible for harm to various parts of the world. Current UK involvement in war against Russia is also deeply abhorrent. Another reply by Ina Badar reads that this list is incomplete. I'll add two FYI. One, expelling Mauritius natives from Diego Garcia Island and giving it to the US Army. And two, UK destabilizing actions in Somalia. Another reply by Kalaivendan reads, 2009, UK helped to Sri Lankan genocide on Tamils, which killed 0.15 million people. The monarchy came under fire on Twitter by nationals of other countries from all over the world besides the British, which the UK subjected to or still subjects to colonialism and imperialism. You know, the list is so long that we're honestly unable to name all of them in this edition. So let's take a look at some tweets, our final batch. Lord Abraham Mutai said, let's be honest, Britain violently colonized Africa. They brutally murdered our ancestors. They brutalized our mothers and fathers. That is the true legacy of Queen Elizabeth as far as Africa is concerned. That we are hanging on to the Commonwealth years later is a travesty. Davande has our next tweet. England killed 9 million Iranians, half of the population, 100 years ago, and destroyed a large part of Iran. He's referring to the World War I years. Elizabeth, in her 77 years of rule, not only did not apologize and compensate, but also continued the crimes of England against our country. Subham Sahu has our next tweet. In nearly 200 years of genocidal colonialism, the British Empire stole $45 trillion in wealth from India, 17 times more than UK GDP, killing millions. The UK monarchy, Queen Elizabeth, the royal family are simply symbols of murder, exploitation, and theft. Michelle Maliketo Melanga has our final tweet. What sort of a queen commits crimes against humanity and gets away with it? She did this not only in Africa and the Caribbeans, but India, Yemen, and Pakistan as part of her duties. Are we going to be silent about that? And that's a wrap for this edition of Hashtag Trending. Until next time, take care and bye-bye.
Authorities in the French city of Lille have stopped lighting in public buildings to reduce energy consumption. This as Europe is suffering from soaring energy prices ahead of winter. We have discussed Europe's energy crunch in our news review program. Let's take a listen.
It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. Civic officials in the northern French city of Lille have stopped lighting of public buildings to reduce energy consumption as Europe grapples with soaring energy prices ahead of winter. The measure is part of a package that also includes lowering temperature in most public buildings and poles, as well as closing the city's tropical gardens and two fountains. The whole package is expected to cut the city's energy use by 7%, saving 1 million euros in energy costs. France, like other European nations, faces a hike in fuel prices due to reduced gas supply from Russia following the war in Ukraine. In Britain, the largest energy supplier, Centrica, is planning to voluntarily cap profits in an effort to cut household costs. That after the new premier, Liz Truss, vowed to cap soaring energy bills for 2 years in order to protect consumers and businesses. Fred Weir is a journalist and political commentator who joins us from Moscow. We also have Marcus Papadopoulos, historian, political analyst, and author who joins us from London. Welcome to you both. Fred Weir, reflecting on what the Russian president, Vladimir Putin, has said about trying to cut off Russia's gas supplies, particularly to Europe, he said that's just an impossibility. Europe is grappling and facing a shortage of energy, in particular gas, of mammoth proportions. At what point do you think they'll realize how deep they're in this in order to see whether they should be treating the Russian factor a different way?
I don't know. It is a bad situation. It's a crisis of monumental proportions. And it is an outcome of the total economic warfare that's going on. I mean, Russia is accused, rightly, of weaponizing energy, but just about every other economic factor has been weaponized against Russia already, from financial to technology to even like mundane consumer goods imports. So Russia has been careful about this, but step by step, they are making the point to Europe that Russian energy just isn't a thing to be taken for granted if you're throwing everything but the kitchen sink at Russia. So this is a problem, and I honestly don't know how bad it is for Europe there. It is clear that an economic model existed, like, say, 15 years ago at its peak, in which Russia sold energy and other raw materials to Europe and bought back most of its consumer goods, most of its life-level imports from Europe. Europe was far and away Russia's biggest trading partner. And it's clear now that Europe, especially Germany, built their economic prosperity on cheap Russian energy. Now, all that has changed in the last 8 years. It's been changing, but now it's changing at an accelerated rate. Catastrophically fast. And I guess we're going to find out in the coming winter just how bad it's going to get.
Well, that's the whole thing, Marcus Papadopoulos, isn't it? The mere fact, the last sentence there that Fred Weir said, we're going to find out what's going to happen. That's what the societies in different European countries are facing, the unknown, including the governments, I'm assuming, because we're not seeing a real clear-cut plan. We saw what happened in Prague last week. 70,000 people showed up. So the reasons for social unrest to occur are pretty high. Are the European governments really facing up to the music, as they say?
I would like to very quickly comment on the current military situation in Ukraine. Now that the Russian army is in Ukraine, the Kremlin and the Russian people as a whole are resolute in their determination to see the Russian army victorious. And the Russian people will consent to, for example, 1 million Russian losses if that means that the Russian army either capture all of Ukraine or most of Ukraine. That is the traditional Russian mindset in war. Now, turning to the energy crisis plaguing Europe, it is abundantly clear that the European Union elites care nothing for the welfare of the ordinary European man and woman. The European Union elites are loyal only to the United States government and the various tentacles of the United States' empire, which includes, of course, repugnant organizations such as the World Economic Forum. The European Union leadership is not loyal to the ordinary European man and woman. No, the European Union leadership is loyal to those whom it serves, to those whom have given it its wealth and its status.
Thank you so much for that. We appreciate it. That's Fred Weir, journalist and political commentator there from Moscow. Marcus Papadopoulos, thank you. Historian, political analyst, and author. We appreciate your comments. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of the News Review. Thanks for tuning in.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. We'll be right back.
in the limelight. In the U.S., Judge Eileen Cannon's special master ruling bars prosecutors from reviewing seized records as part of a criminal investigation. Many legal experts believe finding people who have the necessary experience and security clearances to handle the highly classified documents and the willingness to enter the political brush fire surrounding the probe will not be an easy task. Please stay with us for more. The Reuters news agency has this to say. A federal judge has given the U.S. Justice Department and Donald Trump's lawyers until Friday to come up with a list of potential candidates to serve as a special master to review records the FBI seized from the former president's Florida state at Mar-a-Lago. But finding people who have the necessary experience and security clearances to handle the highly classified documents and the willingness to enter the political maelstrom surrounding the probe will not be an easy task, according to legal experts. If we're talking about highly classified material, there's only a relatively small number of individuals who would satisfy the requirements of the job, said attorney Kenneth Feinberg, who served as a special master for the 9/11 Victims Compensation Fund. It would have to be somebody willing to take on the hurricane. It's not purely a security issue. It's become a huge political issue, he said. One illustration of the challenge, the non-profit law firm National Security Counselors last week provided the court with a list of four potential candidates with expertise on executive privilege. All four candidates have since made public comments that either suggest they don't want the job, or that could be used to argue against them by lawyers for the Justice Department or by lawyers for Donald Trump. U.S. District Judge Eileen Cannon on Monday ruled that a special master should review the records seized from Donald Trump's Palm Beach home to weed out anything that should be kept from prosecutors, either due to attorney-client privilege or executive privilege, a legal doctrine that shields some White House communications from disclosure. The U.S. Supreme Court last year sidestepped the question of how far a former president's privilege claims can go in rejecting Trump's bid to keep White House records from the January 6 Select Committee. However, the U.S. National Archives, after conferring with the Justice Department, told Trump's lawyers earlier this year that he cannot assert privilege against the executive branch to shield the records from the FBI. A special master is an independent outside expert who is sometimes tapped to review records seized by the government in sensitive cases, where some of the material might be privileged. Whoever is picked will likely need to have a top-level security clearance, because more than 100 of the 11,000-plus documents are marked as top secret, secret, or confidential. A special master has never before been called on to determine whether records are covered by executive privilege, particularly in the unique circumstance of a former president asserting the right over the prerogative of the current president, Joe Biden. Appointing a special master, I think, may be harder than people think, said John Bolton, Donald Trump's former national security advisor, who previously also served at the Justice Department. How many people with top security clearance are out there, and how many of them are experts on executive privilege? None of the four potential candidates identified by National Security Counselors in a court filing last week have openly embraced the idea. One of them, Mark Rozelle, the dean of the Public Policy School at George Mason University, has asked for his name to be removed from the list, telling Reuters, flattered that someone thinks I'm qualified, but I prefer analysing from the outside of events. A second candidate, former Justice Department attorney Jonathan Shoup, has not said whether he would take the job, but criticised Judge Cannon's order in an interview with Reuters on Monday, saying it was filled with inaccuracies about the law and that the judge seemed to be bending over backwards to help Donald Trump. Northwestern University law professor Heidi Kitzrosser, the third candidate, told Reuters that she believes she is unlikely to be selected after some conservative media outlets and Donald Trump supporters on social media pointed to her prior political comments. The fourth person, Mitchell Sullenberger of the University of Michigan at Dearborn, said he does not have a security clearance. A Justice Department spokesman on Monday said the government is reviewing Judge Cannon's order without commenting on next steps. Attorneys for Donald Trump did not respond to requests for comment. Britain's Guardian newspaper covers the same story, but this time from a different angle. The US Justice Department and the legal team of Donald Trump were due on Friday to jointly file a list of possible candidates to serve as a special master to review the records seized by the FBI from the former president's home at Mar-a-Lago in Florida. US District Judge Eileen Cannon, a Trump appointee in Florida, granted Trump's request for a special master earlier in the week. Her order temporarily bars prosecutors from reviewing the seized records as part of their criminal investigation. On Thursday, the Justice Department asked Judge Cannon to suspend two main parts of her order. It said it wants to be able to continue reviewing the seized classified materials for its continuing investigation, and it wants to protect them from disclosure to a special master. It also warned that some classified materials may still be missing, even after an 8th of August search of Mar-a-Lago by the FBI. The investigation turns on whether Donald Trump improperly removed classified records from the White House and stored them at his home in Palm Beach, and whether he unlawfully tried to obstruct the probe by concealing or removing some of the records when the FBI tried to collect them in June with a grand jury subpoena. Whoever is tapped as special master will need to weed out anything that should be kept from prosecutors, either due to attorney-client privilege or executive privilege, a legal doctrine that shields some White House communications from disclosure. The Supreme Court last year rejected Trump's bid to keep White House records from the congressional panel that is investigating the January 6 riot by his supporters. The U.S. National Archives, after conferring with the Justice Department, also told Trump's lawyers earlier this year that he cannot assert executive privilege against the executive branch to shield the records from the FBI. Judge Eileen Cannon's order has been criticized by Democratic and Republican legal experts. Attorneys have questioned the logic of her decision to include an executive privilege review because the records are not Trump's personal property and he is no longer president. The Justice Department's filter team, a group of agents who are separate from the investigators, have already reviewed the more than 11,000 seized records from Mar-a-Lago. That team identified about 500 documents that could be subject to attorney-client privilege. Meanwhile, there are more than 100 pages recovered by the FBI's August search bearing classification markings, including some marked top secret. Legal experts have said that finding a special master that both sides can agree on is certainly no easy task.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio for today's discussion are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Rouhani and Dr. Fakh Rouhani, a faculty member of the University of Qom. Dr. Fakh Rouhani, assalamu alaikum, welcome to your show.
Assalamu alaikum.
And Sheikh Rouhani, assalamu alaikum to you.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Well, welcome to today's program. So, on this day in the calendar of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Ayatollah Taleghani passed away. He is believed to be the first Jummah prayer leader after the Islamic Revolution of Iran. He was a lecturer, a very important lecturer of the Islamic Revolution of Iran, who attracted so many young people to his speeches. He is believed, we can say, to be among the most outstanding intellectuals before and after the Islamic Revolution of Iran. Of course, after the Islamic Revolution, he did not live long. Maybe 1 or 2 years after the Islamic Revolution of Iran, this outstanding man passed away. For today's discussion, coincident with this important occasion, that is the death anniversary of Ayatollah Taleghani, we want to talk about Jum'ah prayer itself. What is Jum'ah prayer and how it can establish brotherhood in a Muslim society? Dr. Fakhwani, let's start with you, brother. How do you find the role of Jum'ah prayer in a Muslim land?
Yes, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim wa bin astayin. First of all, it must be indicated that the Friday or Jum'ah prayer is mentioned in the Holy Quran, and there's a short Quranic surah in this regard.
Okay.
This is an explicit Quranic injunction or Quranic order in this regard. And as we believe that the Holy Quran is the divine text, the divine book intact, there's no doubt regarding its authenticity. At the same time, it must be indicated that the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam was the first dignitary in the Islamic world who established, who introduced and established the Friday prayer. Next, it must be indicated that in several Muslim countries, Muslim nations, people may perform congregational prayer on the day of Friday as a day for, congregation.
That's right.
In the Islamic Republic of Iran, this has been mentioned that, it has various functions. And one of the important functions of the Friday prayer is that people get together and they are informed of the main currents of thought or
That's
main
right.
instructions in the Muslim community.
That's all right. And we know that also maybe some Jummah prayers are held in non-Muslim lands too, but by the Muslim communities. There are some leaders or some imams, who lead a masjid or a mosque or a community for the Muslims in the Western world, for example, or in the non-Muslim lands. But still, the Jummah prayers and the sermons are held over there. Okay, Sheikh Rouhani, how do you find, brother, the role of Jummah prayer in a Muslim land, or spiritually in general?
Yes, of course. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. First of all, I should mention this important point regarding the Jummah prayer. Is this that according to the Islamic teachings and doctrines, Islam focuses and emphasizes very much on unity among Muslim Ummah or Muslim nation. Because before Islam, you see that there were kind of disagreement, tribal kind of fightings, battles among different clanses and, let's say, tribes.
That's right.
So, yeah, when Islam came, actually, the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam tried his best to unite these kind of different groups of people under one kind of,
slogan.
Flag, yeah, or slogan
flag,
of Islam,
right,
yeah. So these congregational prayers and also the Jum'ah prayer or Hajj, these kind of rituals that we have in
yes.
Islam, they unite Muslims, they unite Muslim Ummah, Muslim nations. So that's why we see that one of the main objectives of Islam or the prophethood of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam was this, that to unite Muslim
yes.
Ummah, to unite, first of all, the residents of Arab Peninsula, then the other people who converted to Islam. So that's why I think unity and to be united is one of the very important purpose and objective of Islam.
That's
and
right.
The prophethood of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam.
We know that during a week or during, we can say, days and nights of a Muslim land, the people are supposed to attend the congregational or jama'ah prayer in the mosques. But what would be the most important role of Jum'ah prayer now? Because the Muslims usually take part in the congregational prayer. I mean, what is the difference between this congregational prayer held on the days Friday with the other days of the week, Dr. Fah?
Initially, it must be indicated that when people get together in mosques, I mean, in the neighborhoods, ordinary or, I mean, common prayers or common types of salats are held. However, yes. Ritually speaking, the Friday prayer or Jummah prayer is a bit different from, I mean, ordinary type of salat. I mean, there are not that major differences. However, in some rituals, they may be different. This
That's
is
right.
one. And another one is that Jummah prayers or Friday prayers are held in very much larger space.
Yes.
And, I mean, more people may attend.
Mm-hmm.
Usually, for example, in Muslim lands, and specifically in the Islamic Republic of Iran, we find that on the day of Friday, I
yes.
mean, at noontime,
yes.
okay, local mosques are closed.
That's right.
And only those places for Juma prayers, for Friday prayers, are open.
Yes.
It has an implication.
Mm-hmm.
The implication is that while throughout the week people are permitted and encouraged to go to the local or neighborhood mosques,
mm-hmm.
on the day of Friday or Jummah, people are expected to get together, larger crowds of people get together.
That's right.
Yes. And more important topics
yes.
will be covered over there.
That's right.
Yes.
And we know it has two sermons, isn't it?
Of course.
Jummah prayer. The first of which I think is about religious content,
yes.
and the second is about the socio-political and the cultural content, not only of the Muslim land, but around the world. And this shows how this prayer is important, I mean, for the Muslims. But let's talk a little bit about the quality of Jummah prayer itself, Sheikh Rouhani. How is it held and what should be done in that? And, for example, what are these sermons at all? What details should be tackled by the imam of the Jummah prayer?
Yes, of course. One of the responsibilities of the imam Jummah or the Jummah prayer leader, is this, that to inform the people of the importance of unity,
mm-hmm.
of the importance of religious beliefs and doctrines and teachings. As you rightly mentioned, in the first sermon, the leader have to actually remind the people of some of the main and important kind of Islamic teachings and
yes.
doctrines.
Okay.
But in the second sermon, the leader has to actually touch or, let's say, deal with the daily affairs or the important kind of political or social or even sometimes economic kind of issues.
Yes.
It makes no difference whether they are kind of internal kind of issues or sometimes international kind of
okay.
issues which are related to the Muslims' lives.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why in these second sermons, of course, the leaders and the imams have to actually inform the people or warn the people of some of the very kind of important or challenging kind of issues that the people may face.
That's right.
In modern days.
So you mean the imam of a specific land, for example, Iran, Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, or, for example, Kuwait, as a Muslim, has to be concerned about the affairs of the Muslims all across the world, isn't it?
Of course.
And tackle such a question.
Yeah,
you mean,
it is.
In the Jummah prayer, we must not be neutral to the cases regarding the Muslim lands, isn't it?
Of course, yeah.
Okay.
When, for example, we have Muslims across the globe, when
mm-hmm.
in some other, for example, areas or countries, they are facing some problems,
yes.
challenging, or they
okay.
are oppressed.
Yes.
So, of course, here it is the responsibility of the imam to inform the people, and the people should actually concern all these kind of issues
That's
about
right.
the Muslims.
Okay.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Dr. Fakhwani, as I said, this day, in the Islamic Republic of Iran's calendar, is the death anniversary of Ayatollah Taleghani. Do you have any live memory from this outstanding man for us and how he attracted the people and the young people to the true message of Islam?
Yes. Regarding the late Ayatollah Taleghani, I do remember his presence. And I met him a couple of times in some general meetings. He was a very eloquent speaker and very outspoken.
Yes.
And, he was a very knowledgeable person. And he was regarded as a sincere companion and assistant to the late Imam Khomeini.
Yes.
When the Islamic Revolution of Iran was in gestation, many dignitaries, religious, political dignitaries, were imprisoned.
Yes.
And one of them was the late Ayatollah Taleghani, Sayyid Mahmoud Taleghani.
Yes.
At the same time, I remember that when he delivered his sermons in Friday prayers, he was very outspoken and very critical of some anti-revolutionary groups and their activities.
Yes.
In the soon after the victory of the Islamic Revolution of Iran, I vividly remember that some people were not able to oppose the Islamic Revolution of Iran quite openly.
Mm-hmm.
Rather, they started criticizing this or that person, and from time to time they started criticizing the whole Islamic movement.
That's all right.
Ayatollah Taleghani was such a personality who opposed them. For example, there were some leftist groups, pro-Marxist groups.
Yes.
Okay? They were very active, and they claimed that they wanted to be on the side of workers or working class of society.
Okay.
At the same time, leftists were in power in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
And then Ayatollah Taleghani made references to the case of Afghanistan and told the leftist groups in Iran that, do you want to change Iran into the next Afghanistan? Look at Afghanistan. There isn't, there isn't safety, there isn't, security, and so on over there.
Okay.
And at the same time, it must be indicated that since the late Ayatollah Taleghani spent much time in prison in the time of Shah, and over there, in prison, while he was in the prison, he had direct contacts with the leftists. He was really very knowledgeable,
well-versed and well-informed
of their doctrines. So almost none of them was able to confront him because he had listened to their arguments in prison. And they had nothing to offer to him.
Okay.
And wherever they claimed anything, it was Ayatollah Taleghani who answered the claims in his Friday prayer sermons.
That's all right. Unfortunately, as you say, these anti-revolutionary, anti-Islamic groups have martyred so many of the most outstanding Jumu'ah imams after the Islamic Revolution of Iran. I've got some names over here. Sayyid Muhammad Ali Ghazi Tabatabai, Sayyid Asadullah Madani, Sayyid Abdul Hussein Dasgheib, Muhammad Saduqi, and Atollah Ashafi Isfahani. These were the great men. And we know these were not just, we can't say young, we say imams. No, they were old. They were, some of them have reached a level of ijtihad even.
Yes,
okay?
Certainly.
They were really, we can't say knowledgeable people who never left the position of leading the Jumu'ah prayer and that position. And most of them have been martyred, unfortunately. Some of them in the mihrab of the masjid and some of them assassinated by the anti-revolutionary group. Okay, Sheikh Rouhani, your final remarks. We got about 2 minutes.
Yes, what I wanted to mention at the end of this session is this, that the imam should be well qualified.
Yes.
And must be a very kind of scholarly kind of figure.
Figure, that's right.
That's why, as you mentioned, the name of these great scholars who were martyred by the oppositions. So, of course, because of their great influence on the people, so the leftists feared a lot these great scholars. That's why they killed them and they were martyred by them. So I think this it shows the great role of Jumu'ah prayer and also the Jumu'ah prayer leaders.
Yes.
in the society and now in nowadays lives.
That's right.
This is what should be taken into consideration while talking about Jummah prayer.
And we hope that Jummah prayer and the congregation of Jummah prayer finds its true place in all Muslim lands, to be concerned with the affairs of the Muslim society, inshallah, establishing a kind of brotherhood and unity, not only among the Muslims of a specific land, but all the people across the world. This is truly a nice podium in order to speak about the unity and brotherhood for all the Muslims across the world, inshallah. Thank you much, Sheikh Tafakhwani and Sheikh Rouhani, for a nice elaboration regarding the role of Jum'ah prayer in establishing brotherhood and unity among the Muslims. It was very kind of you. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Also, our YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
In the limelight. In recent days, Palestinian prisoners in different prisons of the Zionist regime have started protests against the continuous mistreatment by Israeli prison officials. Due to the insistence of the Israeli occupying regime on its cruel and vengeful measures with the aim of destroying the Palestinian organizational institutions, the Palestinian prisoners have started an indefinite hunger strike. Other groups of prisoners have assured to join this hunger strike in the coming days. Palestinian detainees have continuously resorted to open-ended hunger strikes in an attempt to express outrage at their detention. The Israeli regime's jail authorities keep Palestinian prisoners under terrible conditions without proper hygienic standards. Palestinian prisoners have also been subject to systematic torture, to harassment and repression. Concerning this issue, we have taken a look at some of the world media for further details. Please stay with us. MondoWeiss.net wrote, on Tuesday, 6th of September, more than 400 Palestinian political prisoners in Israeli prisons entered their 13th consecutive day of punitive measures imposed on them by the Israel Prison Services, or IPS, including being locked in their prison cells and denied recreational yard time, all due to alleged affiliations with Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement. These repressive measures are also a response to prisoner protest and disobedience, which has reignited the battle of the Palestinian prisoner movement inside Israeli prisons. On 1st of September, almost 10 days after launching a collective civil disobedience movement in Israeli prisons, Palestinian political detainees were planning on going on a collective hunger strike in the light of these punitive and retaliatory measures. Just the day before, on 31st of August, Khalil Awada ended his hunger strike of 182 days, protesting his illegal imprisonment by Israeli authorities without charge and without trial. Khalil Awada is expected to be released on 2nd of October of this year, following his hunger strike's victory. Over 7,000 Palestinians are documented to be imprisoned by Israel, including 32 Palestinian women and 175 Palestinian children and minors. Many Palestinian detainees are either arrested by the military in overnight raids that collectively terrorize entire neighborhoods or entire villages and towns, or are arrested at military checkpoints, which are guarded by heavily armed Israeli soldiers. Palestinian political detainees are regularly exposed to systematic mechanisms of abuse, mistreatment, and torture. Palestinian political detainees have been warning against the abuses practiced by the Israeli prison service ever since the Gilboa prison break of September 2021. Palestinian political detainees recognize that Israeli practices against them continue to escalate and intensify. In the light of these conditions, they have reoriented towards a new strategy of unity across political factions. The anti-war website elaborated more about the story, saying, according to the Palestinian Commission on Detainees and Ex-Detainees Affairs, around 1 million Palestinians were imprisoned between 1967 and 2021. Currently, hundreds of Palestinian administrative detainees are held in Israeli prisons, an act that violates international law on various counts, holding prisoners without trial and without due process, and transferring prisoners to enemy territories, the latter being a stark violation of the Fourth Geneva Convention of 1949. Of course, respecting international law has never been Israel's strongest suit. In fact, the Israeli regime continues to deliberately ignore international law in numerous aspects of its illegal military occupation of Palestine, rationalizing such actions on security grounds. Palestinians are also doing what they do best, resist under the harshest of conditions, and by every means available to them. Tellingly, the strongest of such resistance takes place inside prison walls, by gaunt-looking and often dying Palestinian hunger strikers. This latest battle has become known among prisoners under the slogan of Unity in Confronting the Jailer, and is being run by a higher emergency committee, which is notably different from how past campaigns have operated, in that they were coordinated through factional heads. According to a spokesperson of the Palestinian Prisoners Society, the most prominent decision to emerge from the emergency committee was the announcement that 1,000 Palestinian detainees would go on hunger strike. This was a measure of last resort, a strategy of pressuring the Israeli prison service to heed Palestinian demands. The Palestinian Wafa news agency had this to say. The Israeli colonial regime continues to hold Palestinians from the West Bank and the Gaza Strip in military prisons after being tried in military courts. Palestinians from the city of Al-Quds and those with Israeli citizenship face discriminatory treatment in Israeli civil courts, which criminalize them because they are Palestinians, and they're considered demographic threats and threats to Israel's national security. Most Palestinian prisoners, including minors and children, are arrested, detained, and illegally transferred across occupied territory into Israeli prisons, a violation of international law and the Geneva Conventions. Prisoners are often isolated from the outside world by the Israeli Prison Service, the IPS, by denying family visitation, limiting access to educational materials and television, and sometimes illegally putting them in solitary confinement. Moreover, human rights experts, international medical staff, and other officials are prevented from visiting these Palestinian prisoners, effectively imposing a humanitarian and a media blackout in the Israeli prisons. Many prisoners are sentenced based on coerced confessions, which are obtained by Israeli interrogators through systematic use of physical and psychological torture, including the use of violence, the use of threats, intimidation, stress positions, sleep deprivation, being put in extremely cold or extremely hot conditions, and blackmail. However, even without confessions or substantiated evidence, Israeli military courts can still arbitrarily hold Palestinians without trial and without a charge, under the provisions of so-called administrative detention. Palestinian detainees are often placed under conditions that leave them with psychological scars, not only making it difficult to endure the prison, but also making reintegration into their communities post-release even more complicated. The heaviest impact is on Palestinian children, who can be treated with a criminality that violates their rights as children. For this reason, Palestinian political detainees continue to battle Israeli colonialism and apartheid from inside their prison cells. Strategies like hunger strikes are used as a last resort to push for negotiations with the Israeli prison service for better living conditions. Often these are bare minimum demands, such as access to family calls, to yard time, and entry of goods.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.